Hello and welcome to a special edition of the DeFi Daily. Earlier today, we recorded a webinar all about DeFi taxes and accounting. It is spectacular. It is a phenomenal group of panelists. It is so much fun. There is so much content jam-packed into 60 minutes. You won't even believe it. Please enjoy this special presentation of a DeFi tax and accounting webinar from Bitwave on the DeFi Daily. Have a great one. All right. I think we're ready to go. We got a good crowd here. We got our panelists. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. My name is Pat White. I'm the CEO of Bitwave. Bitwave is a tax and accounting platform for digital assets and cryptocurrency in general. But one of the things that we handle really well is DeFi. So basically, you know, we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about Bitwave. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the technicalities of this. But if you're looking for a solution that can handle a lot of the problems that we are discussing today, Bitwave has been crafted by some of the people you're talking to, and you're seeing talk with feedback from them. So we can handle a lot of these different tricky situations. So without ado, I'd like to introduce our panelists, and I'll give everyone a chance to introduce themselves. So first up is Kirk Phillips, who's a CPA, as well as I like to think of him as the crypto tax guy. Like that's, you see this, you see him all over the place. Like he runs a few of the tax groups in different cities. He's on a bunch of the boards on taxes. This is my go-to guy when I have tricky tax questions. Kirk. Kirk, you are muted, sir.
I was trying not to make unnecessary noise in the beginning. Yeah, thanks for the intro, Pat. Yep. Just been enjoying the crypto space. And really, we just have a niche firm that focuses on, it's a crypto specialty services. So like I say, I feel like my life would be boring if I wasn't in the crypto space.
Oh, yeah, man. Just doing taxes that aren't crypto. You couldn't go back to that anymore, huh? And so then next we have Libby Schultz, who is a CPA and we like to say a financial technologist. I mean, this lady knows more about what's happening in DeFi than many, many people I know and the future of this stuff. Libby.
Hi, thanks for the introduction, Pat. I would say that, yeah, I've always been a hybrid, both I love going to hackathons, building and things like that, but I also love crunching numbers, both from the accounting side and also from the analytics side. So those data is one of my first loves. And crypto was just a natural place to be.
Yep. Awesome. And then finally, we have Devin, who is the CEO at Radar. And you may all know Radar. Radar is the granddaddy of DeFi. You know, the very first DEX that was ever created was on Radar. Weath, if you've ever used any DeFi product, you've used Weath. Weath was proposed and canonicalized by Radar. I mean, these are the big boys. Devin.
Hey, thanks, Pat. Yeah, Devin Eldridge, COO at Radar. And yeah, just been around the space for a while. A lot of people know us for Radar Relay. We've also done some fun stuff trying to resell before on 20 plus different networks. And now kind of recently moved more of our focus into working directly with protocols, networks, and blockchain teams as an infrastructure and liquidity partner. So yeah, a lot of fun things come up in that realm and Bitwave has been a great help.
Yeah, it's fun having a few, everyone on this call is on the bleeding edge of DeFi in some way, which both is awesome, but also makes me quietly deep down kind of hate them because it's like, we get these emails from them at like 2 a.m, like, hey Pat, we're about to do $30 million into this thing. And you're like, okay, we'll figure out what that means later. So yeah, awesome. Thank you so much. Okay, so let's get into it. We're gonna try to hit on everything. There is so much to discuss when it comes to DeFi. We are going to definitely hit liquidity pools, lending pools, and staking as a high level, because that's just so important. It's so foundational, all this work. We're going to try to get to NFTs because, gosh darn, if NFTs aren't, if you had told me 2 months ago that NFTs would be the absolute bee's knees of 2021, I never would have believed you. Whatever. It's all good. It's amazing. And then airdrops, everyone's always curious about that. And there's some really interesting tax implications and account and income implications for that. First, and most importantly, this is not tax or accounting advice. We are a group of people that are passionate about this and we find it interesting to discuss, but please go consult your own tax advisors or tax professionals with anything. This is not advice. This is not defensible to the IRS that you heard it on a webinar, I don't think. Okay, let's kick it over to, so I'm gonna kick it over to Devin. Devin, what is DeFi for the open-endedest question of all time.
Yeah, I think, so DeFi short for decentralized finance. I think it's, you know, kind of this bucket term that we've thrown everything into for anything peer-to-peer that's financial services on public blockchains. So with DeFi, you can do most things that a bank would support, earn interest, borrow, lend, buy, insurance, derivatives, obviously trading assets. And then it's just, I think the big difference, it's obviously faster, doesn't require the paperwork or a third party necessarily. And, you know, just being in DeFi and crypto, it's global and permissionless. And so, totally. You know, anybody can kind of access all these protocols and transact how they want to. And a lot of that, you know, I think a lot of that today has been around Ethereum. And we're definitely in a stage where we're seeing that start to branch out at a higher pace here really in the past month, I would say. So new networks such as Binance Smart Chain, Matic or Polygon, which is the layer two, Celo, Polkadot, some others like that.
Yep. I love that answer because it's so, it, without getting too high horse about it, when I, you know, one of the things to tie back to all this and why DeFi is, I feel like one of the reasons it's gotten popular is the whole GameStop thing. Was this idea that there tends to be gatekeepers around a lot of traditional financial instruments, and DeFi above anything else is a way of democratizing and changing access to those instruments. So it's no longer the DTCC that tells you you can't trade GameStop. It's no longer Goldman that has to be doing the bond issuance or the collateralized debt obligations or whatever synthetic derivative they want to do. It is based on this idea that we can totally democratize that. And that's what's so, so exciting about it. But that's also what's so challenging about it is that, like, I just named, you know, 20 things that you could go do in an afternoon that all are incredibly complicated from a tax and accounting perspective. Libby, tell us a little bit about why DeFi is so tricky in that regard.
Well, first of all, one of the things you said earlier was, oh yeah, there's less red tape, there's less paperwork, and that's great. But if you don't mark your transactions, you're kind of screwed. And one of the other things that people don't realize is DeFi is highly experimental. Well, they do realize that, but I don't think they appreciate some of the foibles of that, in that there is no information unless you're screenshotting. All you have is a block explorer to show you what you did. And that's kind of a problem. So really one of the core things that needs to happen for any team that's using DeFi is to set up strong accounting practices and plan to record things with your team, and also to have financial controls so that you know, someone doesn't just accidentally ape into something because they couldn't get sleep and then they swap, or they're like, oh, I moved this thing, and you know, it's not necessarily clear there's a tax implication. They're like, oh, all of a sudden I owe $1 million in tax that I don't want to liquidate right now. And so, yeah, but DeFi is wonderful. It also has creative instruments that let you, like, you know, oh, I can't pay my taxes. Well, maybe I should just drop it into BlockFi and just take a loan and use that money to pay my taxes, because, you know, the US dollar is the only thing the government accepts.
It's so funny. Like, this happened to me the other day as I was recording a little demo with just doing a little, like, tiny little DeFi transactions. And the gas price on Ethereum snuck up on me. So I was about to, like, move something like $15 worth of tokens. And I almost clicked accept on like a $250 fee. I mean, just not even thinking about it. So this is all about this, you know, how you're doing controls, how you're being diligent about it, and making sure that everyone in your organization who's going to be doing this understands what gas fees are and how that all works, and all those different parts of it. Totally. Great, great answer. Okay, so let's dive into one of the most popular versions of, you know, because DeFi covers all of these different things. One of everyone's first entrances into DeFi tends to be through liquidity pools. And that would either be using the liquidity pool to do a trade, like if you're using Uniswap, you're using a liquidity pool to do a trade, or making money from it. So by staking or providing liquidity. So Devin, can you walk us through a little bit of how this works and what's going on here?
Yeah, liquidity pools. So often Uniswap, SushiSwap, Balancer, these are some examples. And in the decentralized exchange space, these have moved to what are often called automated market makers. And that's kind of where the liquidity pool comes in, is a retail user. You know, you and I can both provide a set of tokens, you know, usually two or more. And that is the liquidity for people to trade against. So when they're trading, within that pool, they're trading against liquidity provided by those retail users. And those liquidity providers receive a portion of the fees. So it's usually like 0.3%, depending on the protocol, but those are provided to all those liquidity providers, and they earn those earnings over time without having to do anything really other than deposit.
Yep. And so there's two parts of that you mentioned. There's one, which is the trading. And, you know, I think the trading tax implications are relatively well understood. Everyone has traded on a brokerage. You know, it's pretty similar. The treatment for DeFi for trading is pretty similar. And ours in Bitwave, for instance, we just treat it exactly the same. Like if you look at a transaction that is a trade on a exchange versus a trade on the blockchain, looks exactly the same. The fees are capitalized in the exact same way. It's just one is fees paid in Ethereum, and one is going to be a fee paid usually in like some sort of base currency on the exchange. We'll talk a little bit about that later, because there is a really interesting effect you can get into where if you're capitalizing your fees for trades, you end up with, you know, disposing of some Ethereum, disposing of whatever you're trading. So disposing of some WEETH, let's do actually of WBTC, and then acquiring some AV. So in that case, you're it's this weird, you know, multi-asset on different sides that you actually have to calculate the cost basis carry forward. We'll talk about that later. But what's most interesting is what you mentioned around these liquidity pools. So you as an investor, someone who wants to make some money, you take a bucket of ETH and a bucket of BTC, and you're going to provide liquidity to someone like Uniswap. Kirk, walk me through where this gets problematic or interesting from a tax perspective.
Sure. Well, first, I was going to just take a step back and just go back to the basics first. I think it'll help set the tone on anything that we might talk about tax-wise. So really, when it comes to types of income, you have essentially two buckets, really, you know, oversimplifying a bit, but essentially two buckets. You've got ordinary income and you've got capital gains income. Okay, so basically, when it comes to capital gains, for US purposes, you want to just distinguish what a long-term capital gain is, 1 year and one day, because that's the most coveted bucket of income you could possibly get of all types of income, rental income, royalty income, business income, you name it. That's the most coveted bucket. So if it's not a long-term gain, that means that it's a short-term gain, and short-term gains don't actually have any distinction at all. Short-term gains simply just default over into ordinary income, into that bucket. So if it's not long-term, it's short-term. Short-term is actually ordinary income. Ordinary income simply means that unless any income is otherwise distinguished in a special category, although that's special tax rate, that it simply is income applied to a marginal tax rate system, which simply means there's a tiered system, which goes from lower rates, depending upon levels of income, to higher rates and so forth. So when somebody says, you know, what's your marginal income rate? It just means what's your highest watermark point is income. That's your highest tax rate. So of course, the more you make, the more it's taxed. So obviously, again, going back to the most coveted bucket of long-term capital gains rates, the higher your income, the more desirable that bucket is, because it's a much lower rate relative to your higher rate as a higher, you know, higher rate taxpayer. So with that being said, yeah, with the liquidity providing, so if you were to put in the two assets, you are containerizing those two assets. Like you said, you could have other things that happen from that. You could earn fees. You could, as a reward, earn a token from the platform. And we're not talking about the token that's what I would call the representation of the liquidity pair. That's you know, called the liquidity pair token, if there is one. I think of that as more like a representation token. It just represents the containerization you just made of the two assets.
And right? That's where it gets really tricky, right? Is you're taking the two assets, and for a lot of these pools, you put them into the pool, and you get this holding token back. And so there's sort of one treatment, which is you treat that as a trade, but that's terrible.
Right. That's right. I mean, if in a literal interpretation, I guess, of the, you know, the rules, it would say, all right, yeah, you're trading one asset for another asset. But what I'm saying is I think of that token there. And again, we're not talking about a governance token you get as a bonus, because that's another asset basically created out of thin air, let's say. Not talking about that. Just the one that represents the pairing that you just created. That's why I just kind of call it representation token, not like that's a term that's even being used anywhere. But yeah, it could be one argument is, oh, you know, yeah, as soon as you trade that and put, let's say, Bitcoin and ETH pair together, then or whatever the two assets are, you know, you would created whatever your basis was in those two assets, you just created a gain just upon creating that liquidity pool, right?
And here's the problem here. I mean, that could be like let's say you have Ethereum from, you know, when it ICO'd, which is like at a $5
exactly. cost basis. Exactly. That's what I call
it. You put it in at $2,000, right. Like boom.
That's what I call zero basis Bitcoin. And that's the term that I use, which means when I say zero or ETH based, zero basis ETH, I mean, it doesn't mean it's exactly zero, but it's close enough that it's all gain, right? That's exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. ICO style, you know, ETH.
That's pain right there. Like, you know, like that could be an enormous capital gain that essentially is you pick up the capital gain without really having done anything and sort of, you know, just because you still have access to those tokens in the liquidity pool.
Now, the other end of the spectrum is someone who said, oh, look, check that out, man. I want to go try out this Uniswap thing and, you know, provide some liquidity. So what they do is they actually take USD and they go buy, you know, ETH and synthetics just straight up, you know, and go buy it. And then they go put it in the pool. So let's call it time zero. Not exactly, right? But they do it all in one shot. In that case, whatever they put it in for is the basis. So that if you did apply that same rule we're talking about, you would actually have zero capital gains because you just bought it and then you, you know, provided liquidity versus the other end of the spectrum, zero basis Bitcoin, zero base ETH. So, but that's one argument that people have out there. And then the other one is, well, you're just actually containerizing the assets and you're not actually, you know, you're not actually triggering a trade for tax purposes. So I actually, you know, side with the latter for various reasons, but, you know, one of those is I say, well, what's the intention? And what's the economics of what happened there? The intention wasn't, when you're providing liquidity, the intention is not to exit from one asset and to enter into another asset like you are in a trade. Because you want to sell, take profits and reinvest in another one. Your intention is exit coin A, enter coin B. That's not the intention here. The intention is to provide liquidity for purposes of earning fees and these other things that we talk about that you can get from doing it. So therefore there's that.
Yeah, and that's a great point. So, and that's kind of where Bitwave comes in a little bit, is because one of the treatments that we can help with is if you containerize the asset, if you treat it in a containerized way like that, what's happening is that then the way the liquidity pool works is you are then seeing trades happening. So other people are doing these trades against your assets. So when you uncontainerize them, which is probably a good way to think about it, what you put in, it will be different from what you put in based on the trades that have happened. That'd be the value change of the respective assets, as well as any fees that have been gathered. And so where we come in is that we can basically help you recognize a trade and then revenue as a fee, or as the fees gathered on top of your assets there. So that's like you're basically the way to support that model of containerization.
Just one other thing to add to that too, because when you put those assets in there, and if it's if they're getting rebalanced, it's almost like you're selling one and then buying another, like in proportion. It's like, you know, two water columns going up and down. In that case, that could be triggering the gains there, and losses there, plus the fees.
I almost like to think of it like the analogy I use a lot is like a blind trust. You know, you're putting these assets in there and then someone else is doing the trading. You're not picking up, just because you put the assets in the blind trust doesn't mean you pick up the immediate disposition of it, but you still have to pay the taxes as the trading is happening on it. And so you have to find systems to deal with
it.
Awesome. Okay. That's
a
great
one. More quick point on that. Just to support. So to me, like when you go create a Maker Vault, all right, and you put in your ETH mint DAI, like to me, that's similarly analogous to providing liquidity in liquidity pool. And you don't, you know, you're not recognized. I mean, I have heard some people argue that as well, but again, that would be a similar thing. So whatever treatment you apply, it's got to be consistent in both cases, in my point of view.
Totally. Awesome. Okay, great. And by the way, if anyone has questions, there's a little thing. You can hit the little Q&A button, ask questions, and feel free to get in the mix here. We're just having a grand old time. All right. So that was a great segue, Kirk, to talking about Maker Vaults, because the next topic we want to cover is lending pools. So Maker is an example of that. Av is an example of that. There's a few different protocols out there that essentially let you take collateral, put it on into a smart contract, and then get something, you know, basically borrow money against it. Devin, walk us through what's going on here.
Yeah. I think Kirk started to allude to this with kind of the Maker Vault, but you can you can essentially, and Libby talked about it on BlockFi, where you can put in, and this can be in, you know, CeFi or DeFi, you're putting in one asset as collateral, and then you're kind of getting a different asset or maybe more of the same asset as a loan. And so whenever that ratio, you know, that collateral ratio kind of detaches, which is based on price movements, you kind of, it's something you have to monitor. And so lending pools is definitely a little bit more nuanced in the fact that, you know, there's more business risk, especially in DeFi, where a lot of these things are automated. It's not like you're going to have, you know, a lender call you up on the phone and say you haven't paid your bill this month. It's just going to be gone.
So. How does that liquidation work? Because I know that's something that you guys are kind of getting into, is actually, you know, doing that. Like, how does that liquidation even work?
Yeah, liquidations are a little different on each protocol. But essentially, whenever there's a ratio, some will have like a pre-liquidation scenario, or, you know, then you kind of enter into a full liquidation. People can essentially buy these, right? Is your assets that are used as collateral essentially go up for sale. And anybody that's, you know, kind of observing those positions can buy those assets. And if the arbitrage is good enough there, you know, and there's enough liquidators on that network, those will get picked up. So, you know, if you can buy $50,000 of ETH that's collateralized for $40,000, that might be pretty appealing to a liquidator. They can grab those and then, you know, just go resell the ETH and make a quick 10K profit, right? So that's kind of how that works, is you have different, you know, often in the form of bots, but often also, you know, just retail traders looking at, you know, different positions. And sometimes there are different leaderboards on different networks that kind of highlight what some of those are.
When I was going to mention the leaderboards, because it's one of those things that you mentioned it, that it is an arbitraging process, because you will often on the leaderboard see a lot of liquidatable assets that are not getting liquid, or liquidated positions are not getting liquidated because the fees don't make sense, or the arbitrage isn't quite there.
Yeah. And you're seeing that more and more with gas fees too, right?
Yeah.
You know, it might not be, you know, very favorable to make $50 on a liquidation transaction if you have to pay $60 in gas fees.
And then $60 to liquidate, then $60 to trade, then $60.
Yeah, so you're seeing some weird stuff on networks where, you know, you have all these positions that are under, but nobody's liquidating them because the gas is too much. And they're smaller positions, right? Obviously, where it doesn't make a ton of sense to take the profit, but it's very interesting how now you can essentially have this free rider effect of people, you know, who are under collateralized on their loans that don't have to pay them back.
Do the gas arbitrage. That's so interesting. Yeah. How do you have any best practices for watching your collateralized debt and making sure you don't get liquidated?
Yeah, I think, you know, setting price alerts for the assets that you have under management, knowing, you know, what price you put those in at, and, you know, what price you signed up to be liquidated at, essentially, when you did that, and that's all based on the collateralization ratio. So when you're entering in, it'll say, you know, what kind of price would you like to be enter there. And so, you know, if you're putting in ETH at $1,600 and you're agreeing that, you know, at $1,000, you would be under collateralized on that, just know that, you know, $1,000 is very important, and maybe set some alerts around there.
So that'd be where you could, like, even as like a so obviously you guys have very sophisticated tools, but as a retail investor, maybe you just use something like Blockfolio to send a price alert on the collateral so that, you know, with, you know, 10% extra wiggle rooms that, you know, to kind of get in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can do that. And, you know, some of the trackers too are now, you know, bringing in those CDPs, right? So they're showing you your CDP positions. But, you know, as each protocol is new, and, you know, maybe Libby can speak to this, how she's seen maybe some clients, you know, surface that information a little bit more rapidly rather than having to go into the app or interact with the contract address directly from a developer standpoint.
Totally. Well, Libby, let's start at the top of this, which is what is kind of reasonable treatment for on the accounting side for the collateral you're putting in, for the debt you're taking out? You know, is it much different than traditional? I mean, I guess the big difference is we don't always do collateralized debt. Like, we certainly do, it happens, but like, it's not actually something that I haven't done collateral debt in a very long time. And that, in this way of like, I give someone a hunk of gold and they give me back a bunch of money. Like, that's different.
Yeah. So A few things, you know, one of the things you do is you need to be very clear about the price points you're putting things in, whether it be for a liquidity pool or yield farming. One of the comments I kind of wanted to add also is that at the same time you have these exchanges happening, no matter what token you have, even USDC has like a variable rate. It's not like a true pure stable coin because it's not the dollar. And things like MakerDAO or like Rai or things like that, they Tether. Are even more. Yes.
I mean, exactly. Tether's the, I think the most I've seen Tether float is the most of any of the stable coins, which is like 7 cents in one way or the other. I mean, that you see massive float on that. So you do not want to treat that as just a normal, like as USD equivalent.
It might be an arbitrage opportunity, but yes, it's not, you need to be a little cautious with that. So we have these changing things. One of the things that they're working on in liquidity pools is working on the how they decide what amount of tokens you get back. Because right now it's based on a ratio. And if the price of your tokens goes up or down, you basically could come out with less money than when you held it or when you or kept it. So that's kind of one of the things that's developed. And also if it's like a social token or something else that's not really meant to have a value, that also gets confusing. It's like you just want to distribute your token. So you kind of take it on a case by case basis for how you want to treat it. I hate to say that it's a vague answer, but like it's such a deep topic. But like yeah. I would say as a general rule, you know, yeah. Let's say you have an ETH BTC liquidity pool. You know, those prices are sometimes correlated, sometimes they're not. And you know, you move stuff at that moment. You know, that can be an accounting challenge in and of itself because there's high volume transactions. And you might not even want to record every single difference because, for example, if you're using a simple thing in conjunction with Bitwave, you know, fortunately, Bitwave can handle like all the high volume stuff. But like if you were to just try to record that in accounting systems, there's so much volume, it might actually break your accounting system. I actually ran into that.
100%.
Yeah.
We had someone the other day that wanted to be putting, you know, 100,000 transactions into zero. Tell you what, Xero ain't gonna handle that. Like I like Xero; it's a perfectly fine platform. But you start putting that kind of weight into it, it's massive. And then also goes for like QuickBooks, how we do.
It also broke, yeah.
Yeah, and QuickBooks, yeah. It goes for how we do a lot of our treatment because our default configuration is to really act as a subledger where we're only pushing the basically, you know, fair market value transactions like expenses or revenue, but then also true up transactions at the end of the month for, you know, taxable events, gain loss, and then you're unrealized. There are people that are trying to track each of their coins in an account. And then they're trying to keep them in sync across the accounts. Is that folly?
You know what? I think we can get there in discretized amounts. I found that milestones are super helpful. So maybe you check at the end of every day. Maybe you check. So like rather than checking every second, I do agree with Devin that you need to have alerts, especially if you're going against the US dollar. There are other pairs, like I mentioned, that Reflexer, where the coin is supposed to collateralize against Ethereum, for example, where you have a little more flexibility. But even then, you know, like you don't, you know, the problem is if you don't collateralize correctly, you lose a lot. You may lose a lot of money. And if you do it in a coin that's risky, you may even just completely lose your money.
How do you, silly question, but could be, I mean, how do you book a liquidation event? Because like, yeah, how do you book it?
Oh, like how do I book it? Oh, so yeah, we usually acknowledge it at the point that it goes in for the value of the assets. So that part's the simple part. Then acknowledging maybe once a day, I want to take the values and the exchanges of how much went in out, how much I went out and off of a price, or maybe, I mean, you could technically do it for every trade, but I wouldn't.
What about on like a lending pool? If you got liquidated, if one of your positions on a lending pool got liquidated, can you just recognize that as a, you know,
then you would have Bitcoin, losses.
$50,000
yeah,
loss.
It's just a really bad trade.
It's a really horrible trade with lots of losses. And it's actually horrible because like sometimes, you know, people have put their money up and they have a liquidation event, but they weren't taxed because they dropped it into the pool. But the minute it starts selling your stuff, you're kind of screwed and it becomes a taxable event. So let's say you had ETH at a lower price and you know, it had gone up like 20X and then you get liquidated. All of a sudden you owe tax on something where you just did a horrible trade.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
And you no longer have the assets to pay for tax liability, perhaps.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's just like the worst case scenario. Yeah, you need to be very cautious about getting into liquidation scenario.
So that sort of speaks to one of our, because essentially the way we do treatment around these is that we represent these pools as like a virtual wallet. So you move Bitcoin from your wallet to this virtual wallet, but then, and that would be the collateral in this case. And then what we're saying is that when you get liquidated, that just starts selling. So if, you know, so even though you wouldn't necessarily pick up a taxable event when you moved it into the lending pool, boom, someone liquidates you, that's when you get your taxable event right there. Yeah, super interesting. Okay, so now let's get to the next part of this, which is really interesting. So there's we've talked about liquidity pools, we've talked about lending pools. What's happening a lot is you're seeing protocols incentivizing people to use their protocol by offering rewards. And the way they do that is through staking. So Devin, give us the rundown, buddy.
Yeah. So a lot of these involve what are called validators on a lot of these networks. So this can be, you know, you're essentially saying, hey, I'm going to stake my assets onto a validator, run a validator myself to ensure that transactions, liquidations, you know, are occurring correctly. And as a kind of a reward for participating in this and, you know, being a judge alongside, you're getting rewards based on your contributions. And so, so that can come in the form of, you know, sometimes delegating to somebody else who's running a validator and they say, hey, we're going to split the rewards this way, often through, you know, the interface of an app, but you can earn these rewards and they come in all kinds of timeframes. So sometimes they're block by block. So, you know, you might see a slow accumulation of rewards in a wallet. And sometimes they could be periodic. So you could see something like, you know, every day or every couple of weeks, depending on that different protocol. So that's really staking is, you know, just getting rewards for, you know, putting up your assets to participate in this network.
Yep. So Kirk, I would say of any of the things we're talking about today, this is probably where there's the most contention in the accounting and tax community is treatment for these staking rewards. You want to walk us through kind of what the arguments are on both sides and what the two different treatments are?
Sure. Well, it's interesting because when I think of staking income, the way that Devin described it there, it's like to some degree with all the topics that we're talking about, it's somewhat less complex in the sense that, you know, you're getting these periodic rewards that are coming. And I'm sure from a technical point of view, like capturing those, like, so that's kind of more simple than these more complex transactions. But with that said, you can see how that doesn't mean that the tax part of it is more simple. All right. Even though maybe you can containerize it in an easier way. So, you know, staking income would be, you know, at the first glance analogous to any other types of income that you would earn, that it would be ordinary income. I mean, I hate to use certain analogies with legacy financial, you know, terms and stuff like that, but, you know, let's say interest and dividends, things like that. That's the ordinary income.
Totally feels like a dividend. It's just every single block and it's algorithmic versus it's only quarterly.
For purposes of giving some context to what it might look like. Cause I don't want it to then start, you know, trying to make staking mean more about interest or dividends than it really is. It's not, it's different, but from a pure ordinary income perspective, that's where the analogy is. However, I can tell you that there's a group and there's support for where staking income would be considered a non-taxable event until the asset is later sold. And the theory around that is essentially that it's the same as producing any other type of property. So if you're a farmer producing crops, you're a vineyard producing wine, or anything else for that matter that you make in business, and then you basically have the inventory, you know, you're not realizing any income until you go sell it to a customer. At that point, then you would say I have any income. So in this particular
when you're doing that, it gets really complicated doing that treatment for a number of different reasons. But if you are a winery or something like that doing it, isn't an important component of your income, or at least of your taxes, going to be your cogs and all of the components that go into producing that? Like, isn't that an important part of like stack?
Because you got there's some things that could be complex. It's got all kinds of different component parts and all like that. Like the, if you looked at the list of, you know, parts, the total thing that makes up the cost of goods sold for an individual item or a group of items, it could be a very long list. But yeah, nonetheless, you're accumulating cost of goods sold. You sell it for X, cost of goods sold is Y. The difference is your profit, like that. So in this case, you know, staking income would be, you know, the difference is if you were to recognize it as ordinary income when it's coming in incrementally, that could be ordinary income. But if you're not, if you're just recognizing it as, if you're not going to recognize it until you sell it, that's going to create the basis, okay, as it comes in. So instead of ordinary income, it's still the same number. It's either income or basis. But then if we go with the method where you recognize the income when you sell it, it's going to be what you sell it for is X minus your basis of Y, and that's your profit. Except in that case, it will be capital gain, long or short, rather than ordinary income if you go with the ordinary income method. So I hope that didn't confuse things, but.
Well, the way I kind of think about it is you're either going to pay the tax immediately because it's income, because it's tax.
That's right.
Or you're deferring the tax.
That's correct.
Yes. Until later. And that's also why I tend to think of this as like, it's almost like self-evident, which is the more conservative treatment from the IRS perspective, because IRS want their money and then they don't want you not to give them their money, or they don't want their money later. They want it now. So it's like the more conservative treatment, or at least the way I've heard it explained to me, the more conservative treatment is it just recognizes as income.
Absolutely more conservative for sure. And the, I mean, the thing is with the other method is it is more, it actually would simplify accounting and tracking and stuff like that. Could be more beneficial to the taxpayer because you're able to hold it. So if you were forced to recognize it as income, you know, on the spot, let's say, then you would have to go cash some out to pay for tax liabilities and possibly other operating expenses. And so you're foregoing the opportunity cost of being able to hold it. If you want to just, you know, if you're going with the method of deferring till later, you forego the opportunity cost of just accumulation. So if you're basically in HODL mode, you'd be an advocate for tax deferring. And what I'm saying, there's a movement out there. There was a site called staking.tax, or something like that. I forget what it is exactly, but basically there's a group some congresspersons and drafted a letter that they sent to the IRS chief counsel's office, I believe it is. You can look it up on several articles on CoinDesk. If you just search staking IRS, you see the stuff come up. So that's what I'm saying. There's literally some advocates at that level, you know, so there's different camps, but yes, the conservative camp is income when it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like, who doesn't want to just
book versus tax camp there?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Devin. What was that?
Yeah, I think, you know, you could even see arguments for like a staking business, right? Because they kind of want the book benefit of showing that income, right? That's their revenue generating activity that they do. And so they might want to show that as revenue, but then, you know, argue on the other end that, you know, it's not taxable until sold. And like I said, some of these protocols, you have to go in and, you know, manually claim those, you know, pay gas, do a transaction on the Ethereum blockchain to claim those rewards. They're kind of accumulated in an account. So, you know, it can be really different on if you're just looking at a wallet, it's not going to necessarily have the rewards in there.
Well, and that's something that we've kind of built in to Bitwave is there's this other thing with that let's see what our next topic here is. Yeah. So the next topic is yield farming and some of these yield vaults. Cause this is the other side of this where it's, the treatment is, or it's, it almost looks and smells like staking in some ways, but it's a little bit different. I'm going to say one thing really quickly about staking, just to finish that thought though. There's one other thing here, which is also interesting, which is I bet a bunch of people here are doing ETH 2.0 staking. ETH 2.0 staking is yet another issue because you can't go and claw your rewards or your tokens back. So essentially right now, the way ETH 2.0 is working is you stake these tokens, 32 tokens per validator. It is locked up there until a future event happens, which is determined by some dudes who only have GitHub handles. I mean, it is like, you know, for all intents and purposes, that really looks like a non-callable debt or some, if this is something moving off of your books that you're just tracking as an asset or potentially, but you might have to mark down at some point in the future, that ETH 2.0, I would say, has a very different treatment even to all of the other stuff that we're talking about here. Okay. So yield farming is then another thing on top of this. This would be like Harvest or Cream. There's a lot of them that are out there. This is where you put some tokens in and then essentially you start getting interest on them, right? More or less. Devin, you want to kind of elaborate on what it's doing behind the scenes, like how it's even making that happen?
Yeah. So similar to pooling, you can kind of put these assets into a smart contract. And what these teams will do on the back end is they'll take those and put them into the different protocols for you. So instead of you going to, you know, Compound and Aave, they take all those pool tokens, they give you a kind of a replacement token, and they go put those funds to work on those different types of protocols to yield on that asset. So you might take USDC, put it into something like a Harvest, and then they'll go put it to work on Compound, Aave, and a litany of other protocols. And so you'll earn some interest on that USDC. And then on the other end, they're giving you also rewards that are incentivized, and those incentives change constantly for different pools or tokens that they want to incentivize. And so they give these governance tokens that are created to kind of put, you know, make the incentives high enough to give people the, you know, willingness to put money into these pools as like kind of an added benefit. And that governance token can, you know, be claimed, sold. It can be, you know, restaked, if you will, to earn additional rewards. And then it can also, you know, be used for governance. So it can be used to vote on different roadmap items or, you know, protocol upgrades for that different platforms.
Yep. And so this is where some of the treatment question becomes really interesting, that you kind of brought up before, which is that you actually have to do, you have to, you know, so essentially the way your vault will work is you'll put some tokens in, and then what will happen is you'll just start to see your balance in that vault go up. So it's like the redemption token you have basically starts being worth more and more that you can reclaim out of the vault. So there's kind of this world where if you wanted to, you could basically take the interest out of the vault and treat that as a transfer up until the point you have transferred out all of the tokens you went in to keep it as a wash from a tax and accounting perspective. So you think about this, like with these vaults like this, the way we do our treatment that's sort of interesting is that we sort of treat it as a cash flow calculation, like an ROI cash flow calculation. It's the amount in, the amount out, and then the total that's being held in the vault itself. And so one way you could do that is you basically could just let people pull the interest out until they got to the point where their withdrawals match their flow in. And that itself also potentially looks like a deferment of income, because you have access to that full bucket of revenue that's in the vault at any one time. You can go and claw all of it back. And so, but if you just choose to claw back a little bit and you're sort of saying like, hey, we're not recognizing revenue on that. So that's why, you know, like what we've done in these situations is basically we sort of do an aggressive recognition treatment, which is that we always look at the delta from the last time we looked at the vault to this time we look at the vault, and whatever that delta is that's gone up or down, that's, we actually immediately recognize that as revenue or as an expense. So there's another situation here where you can get, these vaults can get hacked. Devin, maybe you want to tell us a little bit about like some of the hacks that have happened. These are crazy.
Yeah. A lot of these happen using flash loans where they'll try to say, all right, here's the underlying, you know, currencies that are in there. So it could be USDC, USDT, and they'll kind of flash loan against them to really just drive down the price and drive up or down, I guess, in the situation. So, and then just kind of, you know, do that a few times and we'll, you know, sometimes it gets noticed, sometimes it doesn't in time, but those prices can fluctuate. So now all of a sudden you have this replacement token that was supposed to be tied to, you know, a stable coin and increasing, but now is worth less because they've kind of crashed the price there. So There are different scenarios where, you know, the price can go down. Typically you do see it, as Pat mentioned, you know, kind of going up block by block. And as you said, it's usually, you know, claimable immediately. So you can kind of see that growing, and it kind of like is an interest, if you will, but there's definitely a risk of loss there.
There's definitely kind
of going back to the base asset.
It's one of the, I'm not a tax professional, but I kind of think that there's a consistency thing here, is that you can kind of pick, you know, if you want to do a treatment where you defer recognition of that as long as possible, then I feel like what you do is you end up doing the treatment where you treat it as a trade. So you treat the money in as money in, or like you, tokens into the vault, and then the vault redemption token as a straight trade. That then allows you to essentially defer your interest. You pick up the cost basis, but you defer your interest for as long as possible on the interest. I love the attacks on this though, because there are not very many novel security attacks. Like, I'm a security guy for a long time, and there's, you know, every couple of years there's one new novel type of attack against computer systems. Flash loans are the most novel type of attack that have come out recently. It's this idea that someone on the blockchain will borrow $100 million and do some manipulation of a smart contract to screw with the internal algorithms that are helping to balance these pools out. They are the coolest attacks, and they are so hard to defend against. I mean, every single pool has had one at some point. So
and these all happen in one transaction.
There's nothing you can do about it. You can't do anything to stop it. It's crazy. You don't see it kind of building up. It's like suddenly some dude does it in the middle of the night, and boom, like $30 million disappears to their account.
They don't even need to have like all that money. You can just leverage and get that money anyway, and then basically go on an extreme leverage flash loan and then exit.
It's nuts, and it costs nothing. I mean, like, some of these flash loans to borrow $100 million might cost $1,500, $15,000. I mean, the ratio is staggering for how big it is. One thing I want to make sure we get to is, because it comes up a lot, and Libby, maybe you can help me out here, is airdrops. There haven't been a lot that have been worth anything, but there have been some, and those have caused us all some great headaches. Libby, you want to talk about airdrops really briefly?
Yeah, sure. So effectively, airdrops are related to all the things we've been talking about, but basically it's when someone sends tokens to your wallet. And this could be, you know, you were expecting it, or it could be completely out of the blue. There are people who even spam airdrops, and I know that Bitwave is constantly turning them off because, you know, the default of the IRS is something along the lines of, you know, hard forks and airdrops are taxable events. But one could argue, I think a lot of people got this Kick token, for example, that's basically worthless. And we're like, yeah, no, that's not real, you know. So it's almost like spam email, and arguing that spam email is something that's worth something. But when
Kick was a real tricky one, right? Because Kick at some point did have some value.
It was like 20
there was
bucks.
A point in time
at the airdrop. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. At the airdrop, it had some value, and then it went to zero. So like that adds a whole nother level of complexity around the accounting and taxes.
Yeah, it does. And the other thing that's complicated about airdrops is some of the airdrops are claimable, where you go to a platform and you click claim or whatever. They usually try to make it user friendly. And some of them are just straight to your wallet. So the ones that are claimable, there's a couple of questions. It's like, was it like the UniDrop where they claim that it's a dollar, and then by the time you get it, the price went up over the first 4 hours to $3? Or does it happen at the time you claim it? Can you have it at zero because it was zero because, you know, we got it at the very beginning? So there's a lot of argument behind how you do it. And one other thing I was going to speak to on the tax thing is, you know, in general, yes, deferring taxes in a rising crypto industry where prices and value of crypto is going up, that's generally, you know, a good strategy to pay, you know, to minimize the tax you pay. However, if you know some laws coming out, and this could happen over the next few years, where capital gains, for example, become more expensive, you might be like, actually, no, you know, I actually really do want to claim a lot of my tax because it's a thing. And so the same thing with airdrops. And then especially if you take an airdrop and then you redistribute that airdrop, which you can do, you're like, oh, I got this, and then I'm redistributing it. One of the things that you might do is you receive an airdrop and you're like, oh, you know what? I got this cool bag of coins. I want to distribute it with all the people who've supported our community. Then you, the minute you redistribute that and you airdrop, then you need to recognize that at the token value, generally speaking. And then that can offset your own airdrop as well. So those are all strategies.
The Uni airdrop was 1,400 tokens, right?
400.
Yeah, I was trying to remember how much.
Yeah, the base Uni airdrop
That's worth $13,000 now. That is crazy. Right. Like, that is so crazy.
I just wanted to add something real quick to that, Pat. Yeah. I can with the airdrop. So, so airdrops is, you know, what I believe would be considered unsolicited property. And there's precedent and cases around how unsolicited property is taxed. Now, this is something IRS has not spoken to or used these terms or anything like that in the guidance, but this is from the, one of the groups I'm involved with. Right. So, and the question is if it's unsolicited property, just because you have what some might say possession of it doesn't mean it's taxable income. Okay. So when would it become taxable income? Potentially it could be when you exercise dominion and control. Dominion and control is a longstanding doctrine, and what that looks like may be different from one context to the next. So in crypto, the question is, what does dominion and control look like? So for an airdrop, like I said, yeah, most of the time it's like going to sleep at night and have a brick show up inside your wall. Most of them are red bricks. Occasionally there's a gold brick, like you said, right? So if you don't know what's there, which is the case, and then you got all kinds of like the landscape for types of airdrops is a, you know, wide ranging kind of a thing. So, you know, again, yes. If you, so what is exercising that control could be, you know, clicking a claim button and things of that nature. Cause otherwise you could, in theory, never claim it. And you never take possession or anything like that. So you have to take an action. There's got to be something that you do to claim it. So the timing of that could be make a significant difference in your tax liability.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Also, actually, I love that analogy. Hey, we got a question through chat, which I think is actually super interesting because I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it. The question was, how do we do treatment for? He said token sets an enzyme, but essentially, index funds. So, you know, I, for instance, own a couple. I think I'm in PIPT and ASSI, which is the Power Index Fund. TokenSets has the DeFi Pulse one. So these would be tradable tokens that tend to have liquidity pairs on Uniswap. So I make the distinction because any Uniswap pool is technically, or any balancer pool is technically an index fund, right? It is a 50-50 weighted index fund, or in balancer's case, it's a, you know, whatever you want. So we've already talked about, but what you don't see is you almost never see people take the governance token for the liquidity pool and create a liquidity pool for it, right? You see people hold on to it. I don't think I've ever seen a liquidity pool from the liquidity pool tokens, although it would be totally possible. It just wouldn't necessarily make a lot of sense. Whereas with these index funds, the goal is for there to be a price that floats for the index fund where it gets traded as a token. And it gets priced. So what do you guys think? Do you, for an index fund kind of thing, do you treat it more like a liquidity pool? Do you treat it more like a token you're buying that's priced? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a subtle distinction, like you said, Pat. But I do think it's kind of the intent here, and the intent of a, you know, token set, or, you know, whatever your private enzyme pool is that you've created, is to, you know, track the prices of those investments and those tokens. And so I think, you know, you're buying into that price and, you know, obviously hoping it goes up, but then, you know, selling out of that. And you can do that, you know, via the new token that you're issued, or you can do that, you know, just exiting the pool and getting all of your tokens back. But I think the intent there is for this to be a new token that is, you know, kind of creating a new price market. So that way you're not as exposed, you know, holding just one or a few of those tokens.
It's a great point. That's why, not to toot our own, that's why you kind of need something like Bitwave, because essentially what you could end up doing and what you end up having to track from a tax perspective, like, could very easily be, you know, and this gets back to that multi-asset thing also, Ethereum into PIPT. PIPT you then redeem for the 8 DeFi assets that it has. And so you need to track your cost basis from Ethereum to PIPT, and then PIPT then you need to then spread that asset, that cost basis across those eight assets. And that's super non-trivial. We've had to do a lot of work to basically, like what we do on our side is we calculate a fair market value for each of the assets and then apply the cost basis kind of proportionally across them, which works as long as the assets have value. But then like Pickle was in there for a while and it had no value. So you end up in these really interesting situations around that where you need to have a tool that's kind of handling it. We have 4 minutes left. And I would love, because it's the hottest topic, I would love for us to talk about NFTs. So who wants, Libby maybe, who wants to tackle this? What, like, give us like the 30 second of what it is, and then give us like what treatment you do here.
Okay, NFTs are a huge topic. I know they're all over the news, but basically there's something called a non-fungible token. So for example, Bitcoin, all of the tokens are the same. So one Bitcoin, if I have one Bitcoin and you have another Bitcoin, it basically has the same value and the same thing. Non-fungible tokens, on the other hand, are distinguishably unique. And so usually they are used to represent property. And, you know, in people have it anywhere from Topshop, the moment, or their painting. So it'll often be compared with memorabilia and things like that. But NFTs have, I mean, I won't go too deep down the rabbit hole, but they have almost like an infinite allowable uses, especially when people have multiple NFTs for the same thing or they break them into pieces. So again, this is one of those where it's a case by case. What is the intent of this NFT? Are you, you know, having like 10 NFTs for where people own a portion of your art and they're all the same and it has a value that it was sold at? Are they a cool thing you airdropped to your community because you want to give them a reward? It might even be a scoring system. So for example, it might just be like, oh, you know, we're keeping track of when you help us in our community, you get this NFT. And then later we're going to use your NFT score to denote what kind of airdrop we're going to give you when we ICO. That's like a thing. And so at each of those attempts, you know, when it has a specific exchange for dollars, that's pretty clear. When it has a more abstract thing, you can be as aggressive as you want and be like, well, no, that's not a taxable event because it doesn't have like a meaningful market value yet. And, you know, I feel like that, yeah, this, we're still like learning ourselves how to treat them a lot.
I was using Zapper the other day and Zapper said my crypto kitty went up $1 in value. I don't know how they got that. I don't know how they got that number, but my little green ugly crypto kitty is worth $1 more than it was last week. Kirk, I know you have a lot of thoughts on this. What are your thoughts on like the other tax sides?
Yeah, no, I think Libby had some really great points there. And these NFTs, it's not something that's like, oh, what do we treat it as? It's one bucket. It's not going to be one bucket. They're going to be, I think you're going to find there's going to be a whole range of things they could be, from collectibles, as in anything rare, antiques roadshow type unique stuff, except the digital version, right? To access, and they could even have an NFT.
Let's talk about the collectibles real quick in the last minute, because that's such a good point. Yeah. That's so important.
Yeah. Well, I think you could even have an NFT that actually is part collectible and part something else as well. Now you're getting into something more complicated. But yeah, collectibles are a special kind of capital asset that has special tax rate applied to it, the maximum 28% tax rate. So if you do have an NFT, again, you got to figure out, would it be considered a collectible? And the IRS actually has broad authority on what they will list out as a collectible item. It could be a very, very long and, you know, very general type of list, even down to fine wine and so on and so forth.
So, I mean, so that is probably, gosh, if there's one really valuable piece of data you take out of this, that if you're doing a lot of NFT trading, there's a very good chance that your taxable rate for your NFTs is going to be different than your taxable rate for all of the other tokens and crypto you're doing.
I'm just going to add really quickly too, there is a way to change between fungible and non-fungible tokens, which will make this even more complicated because you're like, well, which side of the equation do I want to be on? What is my purpose? So I just wanted to add that.
Yeah. Well, you guys, thank you so much. We're at the top of the hour. This was absolutely spectacular. This is the brightest group of crypto people in the world. Thank you so much. Thank you to all of our attendees. Absolute pleasure. Great questions. We look forward. If any of this sparked anything in your mind, if you need to do any of this or need any tax or accounting around cryptocurrency, digital assets in general, invoicing, AR, AP, or DeFi in particular, and all the different scenarios we've been talking about, please go out to bitwave.io and sign up for a free sign up for a trial or sign up to be contacted by us. Thank you so much, everybody. Have a wonderful day.
It was very enjoyable.
Thanks, Pat. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.